In the coming week, the U.S. Republican nominating convention kicks off. A coup in Mali shakes West Africa, and post-election protests persist in Belarus. It's August 20th, 2020, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, we are on the cusp of wrapping up the Democratic nominating convention this week, in which Joe Biden will be formally embraced as the Democratic presidential candidate. Next week, the Republicans take their turn, and the plan is to renominate President Trump. That's going to be a mostly virtual event at this point. But as the Republican convention begins, typically you see a boost to the other party holding convention. You have Biden leading in a lot of polls. But what do you think the Republican National Committee plans to do next week to seize the momentum and get people out to vote?
Well, Bob, you put your finger on the big question going into the convention. Is it going to focus on building up President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, or tearing down Joe Biden and Kamala Harris? Now, at the start of the year, the answer looked pretty clear. Republicans are going to run on the record. That's a lot harder to do, and more than 175,000 Americans have died from COVID-19. Unemployment claims are running more than a million a week, and racial and ethnic inequalities in the country have been exposed for all to see in the wake of George Floyd's killing. So I would expect a lot of attacks on the Democrats at the Republican convention, especially given how hard Democrats have hit President Trump during their convention. President Trump isn't someone to let criticisms go unchallenged. And indeed, he's already been firing back at the Democrats through his Twitter feed. Now, if the Republican convention decides it wants to go positive, it certainly has given a theme for itself that would allow that. The theme for the convention is honoring the great American story. And each night has a theme of its own. Monday is Land of Heroes. Tuesday is Land of Promise. Wednesday is Land of Opportunity. And Thursday will be Land of Greatness. Now, as you mentioned, like the Democratic National Convention, which is wrapping up shortly after we conclude this podcast, much of the Republican National Convention will be done remotely. Many of the speeches will be pre-recorded. One of the interesting things about the Republican National Convention is that former President George W. Bush, who is the only living Republican former president, won't be speaking at the convention, whereas at the Democratic National Convention, we saw President Carter, President Clinton, and President Obama give speeches. A little bit different there. President Trump is going to give his acceptance speech on Thursday night, August 27th, from the grounds of the White House, the South Lawn, which is a break from departure. Typically, presidents, when they're in their political role of campaigning, try to create a buffer between that and their role as a government official. They'll let me note that the Office of Special Counsel has approved Trump's use of the White House for his nomination speech and says it's not violating any of the ethics rules that govern government operations. Big question, of course, coming out of the convention is going to be how much will any of this matter? You know, as you noted in your opening question, Bob, we often think of conventions in terms of convention bumps, but with the viewership of conventions seemingly down, that appears to be at least the early returns from the Democratic National Convention. And with seemingly most everyone already having made up their minds about the two candidates, that's at least what the polls show us. It's not clear that, again, barring some major unforced error, that either convention is going to move the needle very much, and that everything is going to turn on who can get their voters to turn out in the midst of a pandemic and get them to turn out in the states where the election is really in doubt.
Those are all good points and food for thought going into next week, Jim. One thing that I'm going to be especially interested in watching is the extent to which the party faithful bring up and address the coronavirus, their approach to defeating it, how the country should be responding to the extent to which they say the president has led on the response versus what might be some new approaches. It just seems like of all the divisive issues, even the lockdown approach, the wearing of masks, all these things became another one where you had seemingly this Republican-Democratic divide. And it still seems to be playing out in debates that deal with everything from reopening schools to football leagues and what have you. Do you see that becoming much of an issue, or is it going to be sort of the issue that gets dealt with on the aside?
Well, I think there are two things there, Bob. One is it a big issue? Certainly is. And I think people want to have some sense of reassurance that there's a plan to deal with these challenges. And I think one of the knocks on President Trump is either that his plans haven't worked or they haven't been terribly good plans. I think it's no secret there's been a lot of complaint that President Trump really hasn't laid out an agenda for his second term. And so that then gets to the question of to what extent will the convention be the place where that positive agenda is put forth, and is the president going to put forth that agenda? To this point, we haven't really seen that kind of agenda unveiled. Could it happen next week? Possible. I don't think it's all that likely. I think, again, just given the way the president's coming into the convention, given his reaction to the Democratic National Convention, the balance between whether to tout one's own record or go after the other guy is going to be focused on going after the other guy.
I think one area that will likely be different based on some of what you said, Jim, is the extent to which other elements of the Republican Party, let's just say, you know, say there's a pro-trade element, the extent to which any of their wishes are reflected in comments or in any sort of platform document. In the same way that we've had what looks to be the case with the Democratic Party and their party platform, which seems to reflect the number of discussions between the Bernie Sanders campaign and the Biden campaign in terms of reconciling some issues involving what's now being referred to as an America First approach to protecting important manufacturing. And you have Joe Biden talking about standing up American business in a way, some of which actually echoes President Trump as well.
It most certainly does. It's struck many of the same themes.
But it also involves elements of a party that was fractured in the primaries, at least going up into the pandemic period. And now you have the Democrats sort of coalescing around a vision of sorts. We'll have to see how that plays out. But is there any sort of a percolation of that kind of debate on the Republican side, or is it going to be much different?
I suspect not, Bob. I mean, the tradition is that when you have an incumbent president running for re-election, that president determines the campaign platform. And I think it's almost certainly going to be the case here, where you're not only have an incumbent president, but an incumbent president who clearly dominates his political party. I don't think this is going to be a time for Republicans to show that they're a big tent and have people with different views on trade or other issues. I think one of the things to follow next week is to what extent the president talks about the rest of the world and talks about what his foreign policy is going to be, and perhaps just as important, how he talks about it. Now, again, if you were to go back to the beginning of the year on foreign policy, the president would be talking about all of the great deals he struck, all the wins he's racked up. He would talk about the trade deal with China. He would talk about the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. He'd be talking about his summit meetings with Kim Jong-un, North Korea. He'd be talking about the pressure he's putting on Iran and go down the list. Here in August, that sort of victory list, that win list, doesn't look as bright and shiny as it did once. Now, the president is going to point to the historic decision by the Emiratis to recognize the state of Israel, clearly something he can speak to. But I think the real question is, you know, when the president does talk about foreign policy, how's he going to describe it? And are we going to see him really sort of go on the attack? Again, think most famously, the way he talks about China the last several months, the China virus and the rest, compared to how he talked about China, talked about his friendship with Xi Jinping at the beginning of the year. So I think, you know, for foreign policy types, that's what to watch out for. Well, let's shift gears, and we're going to go to the continent of Africa. Now, for more than a month, Mali has been gripped by protests over disputed parliamentary elections, rampant corruption, and a violent Islamic insurgency. Then this week, the military ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and his prime minister. The coup leaders say they plan to hold new democratic elections. That pledge hasn't stemmed widespread condemnation of the coup. The African Union, France, and the United States are among those denouncing the coup and warning that it risks further destabilizing a region already beset by violent extremists. So what's on the line in the coming weeks for the people of Mali, Bob?
You indicated some of it in that intro, Jim. I mean, it's a country that's been roiling in various ways for almost a decade now. There was a coup in 2012 that ended up leading to the emergence of President Keita. He has, by many accounts, mismanaged not only the domestic governance aspects, but where you have, you know, rampant corruption, where you have serious concerns about him installing people in offices illicitly, and also failing to handle the fight against Islamic extremists. The coup in 2012 stemmed in part from the emergence of Tuareg rebels. You know, so this was a group that was seeking some sort of a separatist entity. And once they sorted that out and started to establish a peace process, which includes UN peacekeepers, there's about 15,000 of them in Mali, then they turned to other problems. And you, like a lot of countries in this part of Africa, you've got a combination of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and some other possibly unaffiliated jihadist rebels at work. And there's a great deal of concern. Mali itself is this enormous country that sits as kind of a hinge connecting West Africa and North Africa, and unfortunately also tends to be a place that collects people who are sort of drifting across the Sahel and various extremists, lots of guns in the area. And so it's not only Mali that's facing trouble now, it's places like Niger, it's Burkina Faso. So in your setup, you mentioned the concern that's raising for extremism in the region. It's really instability in the region. There are political sort of tremors going on all over the place in West Africa right now. One of the undercurrents certainly is Islamic extremism, but it's not the only one. And it's this problem of deep corruption in governance. And so you have the regional players, you have this group called ECOWAS, which is a regional outfit. And you have the African Union very much concerned about the illegal seizure of power and have condemned that. So have the French, so have the US. But then it's a question of, for the people of Mali, so what? Do they somehow work with this group of military officers to let them buy time to set up some sort of elections but rule in a transitional period? It seems like there's not appetite for that, but it's not clear who's willing to step forward and sort of stage manage some other setting. Most people would think of the French. They have about 5,000 soldiers in the country right now. The U.S. provides a good deal of intelligence and logistical support, but I'm not sure if anybody else has an appetite to actually step into a place like Mali. Again, a huge country beset with a huge number of problems. I should also mention it is a place that, like a number of African countries, a great deal of riches in commodities, but partly because of the mismanaging and the problems of outside interventions, it remains one of the poorest countries in the world.
Yeah, I think that's quite significant, Bob, when you talk about the poverty of Mali. It's one of the 25 poorest countries in the world, population about 20 million, a fair amount of ethnic diversity in the country. And what I found striking about Mali, and this is a trait shared with many African countries, is just how young its population is. The median age in Mali is 16. That means half of the population is under the age of 16. Just to put that in perspective, in the United States, the median age is 38 and a half. So this is a remarkably young country, very big, and as you point out, really dependent upon commodities as its major source of income, and probably has been buffeted to some extent by the global recession that the pandemic has begun to trigger. So it is a country with multiple problems that don't necessarily have easy solutions.
No, I mean, there was the ever-present reminder of the pandemic, of course, was the now-deposed President Keita appearing on television with a mask over his face announcing his resignation and so forth. The country has not comparatively been hit hard by the pandemic. That doesn't mean it won't be. We've seen the way this virus works, but so many other problems. And again, it seems incapable of managing its own affairs. One wonders whether there is any sort of will to provide some collective support. We have seen both ECOWAS and the African Union willing to play a bigger role than they have in past years to help sort of stand up a proper succession of power. This is an issue that is not foreign to many sub-Saharan African countries of either leaders staying too long and not recognizing election results or coups and so forth. There was a coup, obviously, not too long ago in Sudan, where the coup plotters deposed an ICC-indicted leader. And they ended up, so far, people are cautiously optimistic that Sudan might be on the path towards a more representative government and more stability. But Mali is a very different place, and the factors involved there, especially the extremist elements on top of the governance problems. On the one hand, some of the comments by the coup leaders, you know, seem to resonate in that they were just saying this leadership is unable to do what the country needs. There have been demonstrations for a good couple of months before this happened. But by the same token, you know, by acknowledging that a coup is the way to go, it sends the very wrong message to Mali, but to anybody really in this neighborhood of Africa, where instability just seems to be on the rise.
It certainly is. And it has consequences, not just in the region, but beyond that, because a number of Malians have fled the country. They've fled its poverty. And where are they headed? They're headed north. They're trying to get to Europe and to get jobs. And this is true not only in Mali, but of many other countries in Northern Africa, in the Sahel. And it is likely to continue. We haven't even talked about the challenges that climate change are posing to countries like Mali in terms of changing rainfall patterns, vegetation patterns, and the like. And this is a country, as I said, that has a coup, but it also has a very large set of big problems to tackle. And it's going to be a challenge for any government to be able to address them effectively.
You know, I would just add that, again, you have major actors who have a stake here, who have a footprint there in terms of, you know, the UN Security Council overseeing the peacekeeping mission, in terms of the French, who also sit on the Security Council, but have a fairly sizable military contingent there. And again, the U.S. actually has an envoy, well-regarded envoy to the Sahel, Peter Pham, and seemed to be coordinating with its partners to try to do something about this. We'll have to see whether they can set in place some sort of a model, some sort of a path that allows this to pass and not spread further, because all the conditions are there for West Africa to get even worse. Jim, Sub-Saharan Africa is not the only place where we've been seeing widespread protests. Let's go to North Central Europe, in the country of Belarus. There you have embattled President Alexander Lukashenko trying to withstand days and days of protests by increasing crowds against what many see as rigged re-election. He claimed something like 80% of the vote, and that has been dismissed by many observers. And his response to the initial series of protests was a very brutal crackdown, torture of people detained. And he seems to be doubling down and trying to take further efforts and enlist Russian help in doing so. I think one of the big questions, as our colleague Steve Sestanovich wrote earlier this week, is President Putin willing to do, or is he willing to do enough to step in and prop up Lukashenko? Or will he deal with other elites in Belarus who tend to still feel closely affiliated with Russia?
Well, there's still a big question there, Bob, as to whether or not Lukashenko is going to need to be propped up. Now, the protests are continuing, but there are certainly no signs that Lukashenko is looking to step down. In fact, he said earlier this week that protesters will have to kill him in order to get new elections. Now, there's certainly a lot of criticism of Lukashenko outside of Belarus. Many of Belarus's neighbors have openly sided with the protesters. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania have all called for Belarus to conduct new, free, and fair elections. Ukraine has recalled its ambassador from Minsk. And just yesterday, the European Union held an emergency video conference summit on Belarus, which resulted in a condemnation of Belarus's elections. And we're likely to see some modest EU sanctions. Now, the protests in Belarus have continued. They've been sizable, especially in Minsk. And as you note, that the initial reaction by Lukashenko was to crack down on the protesters. He's eased off on that. It's not clear whether this is a sign of strength. That is, in essence, he has things under control, so he doesn't need to repress the protesters, or a sign of weakness. He's concerned that the security forces might rebel if they are called upon to put down the protests. But as you sort of look at it from the outside, at least, there's no clear signs that the Lukashenko regime is splitting. And that's what you're always looking for in these systems. Are you seeing people who are part of the governing coalition sort of reading the tea leaves and opting out? We haven't seen that yet. But as you know, it could happen very quickly. It could happen almost overnight. So a lot of stuff is still up in the air. And again, to go back to where you began, the big question is, what is Putin going to do? He's put down or interfered with so-called color revolutions in other countries bordering Russia. And the counter to that is the relations between Putin and Lukashenko haven't always been cordial. A little bit of a difficult time there. Just as we were going into the elections, Belarus arrested what it said were 33 Russian mercenaries who had come to interfere in the election. Now, after the election, all 33 mercenaries were released and allowed to return back to Russia. The one, I believe, was a Belarusian citizen, so he just stayed at home.
Yeah, that's a good point, though. I think it's worth mentioning that Belarus is not necessarily a client state of Russia. It is Lukashenko asserts independence even while, you know, being a no-holds-barred authoritarian just like Putin is.
Well, I think Lukashenko doesn't see Belarus as a client state of Russia. My sense is Vladimir Putin sees Belarus as a client state of Russia, or that it should be a client
state
of Russia. Now, we've heard that the two presidents have had conversations. Lukashenko has asked Putin for assistance. And Putin has said he will, and let me quote him here, provide a full range of assistance, end quote, if needed. He didn't go into detail as to what that meant. That has led to some sparring going back and forth in Europe, in which Putin has warned particularly German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron not to meddle in Belarus, and German and French leaders saying that what is going on in Belarus is not acceptable. So, you know, we're going to sort of see how that unfolds. And of course, there's the question, what is the United States doing? It doesn't seem to be a lot, at least not a lot overtly or publicly. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said last week that the United States was discussing the situation with its EU friends and partners. And President Trump said earlier this week that he would speak with Russia at what he called the appropriate time. And he added that, and I quote him here, "I like seeing democracy. It doesn't seem like it's too much democracy there in Belarus," end quote. But it's unclear what exactly the president is going to do. And I think it's fair to say it's not obvious what it is the United States can do to change the course of actions in Belarus.
No, I think you're right, Jim. It would be interesting to see what the U.S. Congress might end up doing in terms of leveraging some of its mechanisms like the Magnitsky, you know, human rights legislation, yeah. Maybe singling out some Belarusian officials. Those types of things tend to have a little more teeth, even if they don't sway, you know, government moves. They do have an impact, and they seem to be more effective than kind of pro forma sanctions that are being discussed.
I think you're right that you're likely to see a push in Congress to impose sanctions on Belarus. My concern is that those sanctions end up being more punitive than coercive. And that is, In these instances, they inflict pain on the country, or to the extent they're targeted on individuals associated with the regime, but they're not significant enough to be able to actually change the state of play. If you're Lukashenko and you're saying, "I'm only leaving office if you kill me," then the threat of sanctions probably isn't going to be enough to change your mind. So again, I understand the push for sanctions. I don't think they're going to make a material difference in the outcome of this conflict in these protests. I think this is really in the hands of the people of Belarus, who obviously, as they're going to streets protesting, understand much better than we do what is at stake, because they know what Russian behavior has been like. They know what can happen because they've looked around and seen what's happened in the neighbors, whether it's Ukraine, think of Georgia, in other countries, and they recognize the ability of the Russians to meddle and interfere. And they also recognize the potential for their own government to use significant force against them. But before we close out this segment, Bob, I just want to note there's one other place where there has been significant protests. And I'd just like to touch on it because I know you've been spending some time thinking about it. And that's what's happening in Thailand. Can you just break from our format for a second and sort of fill us in on what's happening there and whether protests in Thailand are going to lead to significant changes in that country?
I think Thailand surprised a lot of people, Jim, because their protests didn't necessarily come from a recent national election or anything, although their elections weren't too long ago, but seemed to be bubbling up in frustration against a still very much authoritarian tinged country, but also remarkably against the monarchy. Now, Thailand famously has had a revered monarchy through the years. So what you had in these protests were people coming out into the streets, you know, venting against what they see as authoritarian practices, but also against the institution of the monarchy. And it's not clear whether you're going to start to see the powers that be suddenly start to open up their government towards more democratic forces. They pretty much, the parties in power now have pretty much sort of blocked out the more, let's say, reformist parties that seem to show gains in the most recent election. They're calling them, by the way, the Hunger Games protests, because people are using this salute that was made famous in those Hunger Games movies, three fingers held up against the sky as a way of representing the true will of the people.
So Hollywood continues to make an impact on politics around the world.
It does indeed, Jim.
Bob, let's shift gears now and move on to our figures of the week. Who or what is your figure this week?
Jim, my figure is Chinese-born, has been in Washington for close to 20 years, and might be one of the more popular figures in the city during these divisive times. I'm not talking about a person, but
I know where you're going with this.
A giant panda. Because seemingly out of the blue, officials at the National Zoo, where this giant panda, Mei Zhang, please excuse my pronunciation, but Mei Zhang is pregnant. And not only a little pregnant, a lot pregnant. Chinese giant pandas are part of a longstanding exchange program that has actually been remarkably successful. Mei Zhang is sort of front and center, one of the great examples of this. She is 22 now and would be the oldest giant panda to successfully give birth in the United States. I think the reports I've seen say the oldest ever to give birth in China is age 23. So Mei Xiang's pushing the limits here. She has already given birth to 3 cubs at the National Zoo, all of which were transported back to China once they reach age 4, which is part of the agreement the zoo has with the Chinese government. Mei was impregnated via artificial insemination just at the beginning of the pandemic period. And then people sort of went about their business. The zoo, like a lot of other institutions, shut down. It opened partially in July. And there were some signs developing that close watchers of Mei Xiang realized involved the suspicion that she was pregnant. And sure enough, and further tests showed her to have a fetus and what looks to be a thriving fetus. They're saying, given the way panda pregnancies work, it could be any day, any minute now that there's reports of a birth. There is also a process that happens. It's not clear whether this is still possible at this stage, but there's a possibility that the fetus actually could get reabsorbed back into the mother's body. This also happens with pandas, which is why the whole approach of having pandas repopulate in captivity is so challenging, but has been a fascinating sort of exchange and case study in U.S.-Chinese relations at a time when, shall we say, these relations have rarely been worse. So let's keep an eye on Mei Xiang. Many people are through the live cam in 2 places, I think, in the National Zoo, and see what emerges.
Well, thank you for some good news, Bob.
I felt honor bound, Jim. So I just hope I didn't jinx anything. Jim, how about you? Who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, I feel bad, Bob, because
you're going to bring us down?
I'm going to bring you down, but I'm going to go with a number as my figure of the week. It's 966. That's the number of pages in the long-awaited concluding report by the Senate Intelligence Committee on possible ties between President Trump's 2016 presidential campaign and Russia. The report's conclusion, there were direct links between Trump's advisors, though not Trump himself, and Russian intelligence agents, and that the campaign's overall behavior posed counterintelligence risks. The report stopped short, however, of alleging any direct collusion with Moscow. The report, I think, adds some new details to what we learned in last year's Mueller report. The more notable fact about the report was that it was released by a committee that the Republicans controlled. So it's really a bipartisan product. The report singled out campaign chairman Paul Manafort's receptivity to Russian outreach as a grave counterintelligence threat that made the campaign susceptible to malign Russian influence. The document also says that members of Trump's transition team should have done more to recognize that Kremlin operatives were trying to recruit them. And the report also discredited Trump's claim that he never discussed the WikiLeaks dump with Roger Stone, which is what President Trump told Robert Mueller in writing. The Senate report says instead that, let me quote it here, the committee assesses that Trump did in fact speak with Stone about WikiLeaks and with members of his campaign about Stone's access to WikiLeaks on multiple occasions. Now, from the president's point of view, there are some real positive news in the probe. Besides saying that the committee did not find any evidence of direct collusion, the probe was critical of that dossier that was prepared by former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele. And the report criticized the FBI for giving undue weight to the dossier's allegations. So this in some ways wraps up the official government investigations into the Trump 2016 campaign's relations or interactions with Russian intelligence operatives. And I'm sure Democrats will point to it and say, we told you so. And I think a lot of Republicans are going to point to it and say, this didn't amount to all that much. So there we are.
And the question remains, as it had been after the Mueller report came out, to what extent does this affect in any way the functioning of U.S. agencies responsible for protecting the integrity of U.S. elections?
Yes.
Does it add any more, you know, reinforcement to efforts to stop tampering, both in the misinformation sphere or in hacking or anyplace else? Not clear.
2 things, I think, Bob, in conclusion. One is that the Russians continue their efforts to try to interfere in the election. I don't think there's any secret about that at this point. And the second thing is that the American public on November 3rd is going to get to decide whether this report, other things it has learned over the years about the president's behavior, matter one way or the other. And that's how democracies are supposed to work. People get to choose.
And that's our look at the troubled world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Myanmar holds a peace conference with armed ethnic groups. Ukrainians celebrate Independence Day. And August 26 marks 100 years since women were granted the right to vote in the United States.
Please subscribe to the World Next Week in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in the World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks to Anna Shortridge for her assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collis. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and be safe.